Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. The 2022 Winter Olympic Games in Beijing will come to an end on Sunday, with Team USA winning more than 20 medals to date. This hour, a look at the highlights and the not-so-highlights, as well as a conversation about holding the Games in a country with an abysmal record on human rights. In anticipation of the Olympics, China not only cracked down on dissidents within the country, but also warned that any athletes who spoke out against the Games or the host country would be, quote, subject to certain punishment. All of this has raised uncomfortable questions about the juxtaposition of an event designed to highlight international goodwill against the reality of a host country with little concern for human rights and even less tolerance for dissent. But we begin with a look at the Games themselves, how Team USA performed, and the moments we're most likely to remember long after the Olympic flame is extinguished. For that, we turn to ESPN's Alyssa Roenick, who joins us from the West Coast, where she's been providing remote coverage of outdoor Olympic sports, including alpine skiing and snowboarding. Alyssa, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
And also joining us is Washington Post political reporter Robert Samuels, who is also a figure skating analyst for the Post. Robert, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Tracy.
So, Robert, I have to start with you because we cannot talk about the 2022 Winter Olympics at all without talking about everything that's been going on in women's figure skating around
Valieva.
Valieva, thank you for helping me with that. What happened last night?
Well, yesterday, Kamila Valieva, she came into the women's final, the free skate, in first place, and she completely collapsed under pressure. And it wasn't, you know, I described it as her... It looked as if she had been taken by a body snatcher. She was stiff in the knees, unsquare in the shoulder. But it was truly the spirit of skating that was taken from her. She's been under such intense scrutiny since this positive drug test came out, along with everyone in the Russian camp. And it cast a pall over the event, which, aside from the disaster of seeing this 15-year-old girl wilt in front of the eyes of the global media, was an interesting competition and a good competition. And in the end, it ended with her teammate, who skated a soaring, really strong, assertive performance, winning the gold medal, but standing backstage alone while her coaching staff tried to comfort this 15-year-old Kamila Valieva after collapsing under the Olympic pressure, and her teammate who won the silver medal through a tantrum because she did not win the gold medal. It was one of the most dramatic and gut-wrenching things I've ever seen in the sport.
Well, Robert, I just have to quote from the piece that you wrote yesterday in the Washington Post, where you talked about Trusova, the one who you just mentioned, who threw a tantrum after winning the silver medal, yelling about how she hates the sport, she hates everybody, she doesn't want to skate ever again. And you, this is how you described her. You said, "Enter Trusova, skating's evil Knievel, who had dyed her hair a hellish red to channel the fiery spirit of puppy-snatching Cruella de Vil, flinging herself into the air with reckless abandon." I just thought that was too good not to share with our audience. But, Robert, a couple of questions occur about this, because there was certainly a lot of outcry after Valieva's performance and her treatment. And you talked about the coaches comforting her, but there were those, including IOC Chairman Thomas Bach and Mike Tirico from NBC, who really excoriated her coaches for doing just the opposite, for sort of leaving her alone. Tirico said the adults in the room did not protect her.
Well, there's a big question about whether or not she should have been on the ice at all, right? As a 15-year-old girl who is in the midst of a doping scandal, does she have the mental fortitude, the strength, the maturity to withstand the scrutiny in one of the most closely watched competitions in one of the most iconic sporting events on the planet? Now, when Valieva left the ice, her coach, Terry Tutberidze, who no one would say is a particularly fuzzy coach, said to her, "What happened? Why did you let it go? You had everything and you let it go." She was baffled and upset. That's what happens in competition. And I think that's going to be one of the lasting images of the game. Her coach, instead of immediately shifting to an idea of comfort and support, tried to figure out what happened to her. And I think at one point she said to her in Russian, "Let this be the worst thing that ever happened to you." Now, after that, as that was happening, there were other people who are associated with the Russian Olympic Committee who chanted her name, who tried to hug her, who wrapped arms around her. So all of those things were going on. It wasn't just simply the tongue lashing of a stoic coach. There were many emotions that were being shared.
Gotcha. I want to come back to that eventually and talk a little bit about, you know, what all of this means for women's figure skating. But Alyssa Ronick, let me turn to you because you have covered a number of Olympic events over the years. You're covering it virtually now from the West Coast. So I'm curious to know what it's like for you as a journalist having to cover the Olympics remotely. And then we'll talk a little bit about what it's been like for the athletes.
It's warmer. I'll start there.
That's a good thing.
I had a couple of moments that I shared as sort of a wrap-up piece that we did of really, really missing being at the bottom of the half pipe and the slopestyle course and the snowboard cross course. Then you see the negative 20, and I rethink that. But, you know, it's been, in some ways, it's much more difficult. The access to the athletes is different. The real feel and connection with what's going on changes being at home. And then in some ways, you know, you're speedier. You're not sitting on buses for 2-3 hours a day. So there are benefits and real difficulties. And I look forward to getting back to covering these things in person, hopefully in Paris in a couple years.
What's it been like for the athletes? Because we've been hearing about a lot of challenges, including COVID protocols, lack of fans, some reports of pretty rough living conditions. What's been going on for them?
Certainly. You know, I think a lot of the athletes I talked to before they went over, they'd talked to athletes who were in Tokyo and really felt that they were prepared for the lack of fans. You know, they'd been competing for the past year and a half without fans. And certainly in action sports especially, the fans are such a big part of an event. But the X Games, for example, went on last year without fans. And, you know, the athletes would say to me, you know, snow sport athletes are so adaptable. It's part of our sport. We're ready for it. But then I think once they got there and didn't have, you know, not just the cheering fans, but their family, you know, the coaching staff beyond, you know, the really immediate coaching staff was not over there. It was difficult, you know, going through the procedures every morning. You know, there were a couple athletes who, you know, as soon as it was over, you know, their first social media message was, "Get me out of here. You know, I just want to get back home. I want to see my family." There were just, you know, it weighs on you emotionally in a way that I think a lot of them didn't think would affect their performance. And for some of them, it did. And for some of them, it didn't. But it was certainly a really unique experience that, you know, I talked to Anna Gasser, who won the women's snowboard big air event beforehand. And she kept thinking, you know, she said, "I don't know if I can finish my career," which was her plan, "at this event. I have so many reasons I don't want to compete in China, and I'm going to compete in front of, you know, no fans without my family. You know, maybe I can dig deep and stay 4 more years to finish this thing off in Italy." So, you know, I think they're all feeling similarly now that they're starting to return home and think about their futures.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those athletes specifically. You mentioned the half pipe just a moment ago. We have to talk about Shaun White, his final Olympics, and of course, Ayumu Hirano from Japan, who was the only one to land the triple cork in the half pipe competition. Talk about what happened there, Shaun White's final Olympics and sort of the passing of the torch.
Oh, what a contest. That was definitely one of those moments where I just thought, I cannot believe I'm not there in person seeing this. It was the most incredible halfpipe contest in the history of snowboarding. Like you said, Ayumu Hirano landed the greatest run in the history of the sport twice. You know, we don't even need to get into the judging, but, you know, inexplicably, the first time he did it, he got a really low score, and he went out and did it twice. And like you said, the triple cork, he's the only athlete who's ever landed it in a contest. I think it will be a long time before we see someone replicate what he did. It was just phenomenal, and it was so nice to see him win. He's been the bridesmaid, the silver medalist for the past 2 Olympics, starting at age 14. So to see him win was just incredible. And Sean, watching Sean through this Olympics has been such a cool process. Yeah. Having covered him since, my goodness, I think he was 14 or 15 as well, and seeing how different this experience was, how he really seems to have been just enjoying the process. You know, he is the most fiercely competitive human being I think I've ever covered in any sport. And to watch him really seem to just care about going out and landing a run and being a part of this for one more Olympics, you know, just making the team was pretty tough for him. He had to go to a qualifier in Switzerland at the last minute. And so to watch him, like you said, pass the torch, there was this really beautiful moment between him and Ayumu, and they have been fierce competitors. And, you know, it was a very public, private moment where he walked up to Ayumu and shook his hand and said, "It's your time. This is yours now." Mm-hmm. Was really, really cool to watch. And yeah, like I said, it was just one of those moments where I thought, oh, I'd be willing to stand outside in the negative 20 for a few hours to have seen that in person. But I think Ayumu, at least, we'll see him in the sport for quite a while still. And his younger brother, who was equally just incredibly, set a world record for the highest air out of the half pipe. And Sean now is starting a company, so I think we'll see him around the sport for a long time as well.
No doubt. Robert Samuels, I've got just about 2 minutes before I have to take a break, but we want to talk a little bit about Nathan Chen and his gold, and also being called a traitor, and the opposite sort of happening for Elaine Gu. But let's talk about Nathan Chen a little bit and his performance.
It seems like a lifetime ago, doesn't it, that we were looking at this wonderful, tremendous 5-quadruple jump performance in the men's field done by Nathan Chen, who's the first American gold medalist in men's figure skating since 2010. It's not just that Chen won, but it's how he won. He has only lost one competition in the past 4 years, and he came to this Olympics in a seeming rivalry that was more media myth than reality. He skated two of his best performances of all time, just smoked the field in a way that was casual and breezy, breezy and full of swag. And it was a really wonderful moment to see in a sport that sometimes gets stereotyped as being a little bit stuffy.
And yet he took some heat from the haters. Talk a little bit about that. Quickly, because we have to take a break in 20 or 30 seconds.
I'm not sure about the heat, actually. What he did was phenomenal, and anything else I feel is inconsequential.
Yeah, there were reports on Chinese social media about him not representing China and skating on behalf of the U.S., and of course, it seems that no matter which country you represent, you might take some heat from the country that you're from or from the opposite country, but interesting story nonetheless. We're talking about the 2022 Winter Olympics. Closing ceremonies are on Sunday. We're talking about the highlights and also about the host country and its record on human rights. More Radio Times when we come right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and we're talking about the 2022 Winter Olympics, which will end this Sunday in Beijing. But oh my goodness, the moments to remember from the Olympics this time around. Our guests are Alyssa Ronick, who is a senior writer for ESPN. She's been covering the outdoor sports at the Olympics, including alpine skiing and snowboarding. She has been covering them remotely. And Robert Samuels joins us as well. He is a national political enterprise reporter for the Washington Post, but he also closely follows skating, and he's been covering the skating for the Beijing Olympics for the Washington Post. Alyssa, I want to come back to you as we've been talking about some of the athletes and their performances. We have to talk about Michaela Schifrin. Really rough time this year.
She did. You know, it's, you know, when you talk about Nathan Chen and Eileen Gu and these athletes who have immense pressure on their shoulders and their ability to rise to the occasion, and you know, this time around for whatever reason. And Michaela has said, you know, she's been so open each time. So to go back, you know, she was planning to ski every event, and there was a lot of talk about her possibly winning 5 gold medals. You know, she is the greatest alpine skier, World Cup alpine skier in history. She was 1 medal away from being the most decorated Olympian. And she skied out in 3 of her races already. And, you know, I think I saw a figure that I think she skied out 3 times in the past 6 years. And so it's just not something she's known as being the most technically superior skier. You know, her 2 best events are technical events. The slalom is the event that she is the best in the world at. And she's now skied out twice in that event. Not, you know, DNF, did not finish those 3 races. And she's been incredibly open, as she always has been, really sharing her thoughts after each race. And each time she says, you know, she doesn't have an answer yet for why this is happening. I think her willingness, you know, it's been almost as intriguing to watch those interviews at the bottom of race courses, watching her in real time try to process what's happening and share the reaction that she's getting on both sides, the support she's getting and the ugliness that she's getting for, you know, quote, failing her country. Mm. You know, she's been through a lot in the past year. You know, the whole world's been through a lot, but you add, you know, the death of her father on top of that, and she got COVID and was quarantined in a hotel in Europe for a couple weeks in the lead up to these Olympics. And I think at a point you can't keep pushing all of that down. And I think we're seeing an example of what happens, you know, unfortunately, you know, in front of the world on the biggest stage in her sport.
Right. And you can't help but think of Simone Biles in the Summer Olympics and just the immense mental pressure that these athletes are under for all kinds of reasons. On the flip side of that, Alyssa, we had Lindsay Jacob Ellis on snowboard cross. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about her performance.
My other FOMO moment. you know, again, to watch, you know, I've been at every Olympics that Lindsay has competed at in snowboard cross. So snowboard cross is a racing snowboard event. She is the greatest of all time. She, you know, in the debut of the event in Sochi, in Torino, my goodness, way back in Torino in 2006, you know, she was the queen of the sport and was anointed. You know, I kept saying people had hung a gold medal around her neck before the Olympics ever started. And there was so much pressure and she was so young. And she had an incredible lead in the final, insurmountable lead. And over the second to last jump, she went over the jump and styled out a method. It was sort of a trick, and was sort of a nod to Sean Palmer, the greatest athlete at the time in that sport. And, you know, and also a nod to her freestyle route. She was a half pipe snowboarder and a slopestyle snowboarder as well. And she fell, and she was passed, in the last stretch for the gold medal. And she has never in the Olympics recovered from that moment. And, you know, I've been at the bottom of those courses and watched the heartbreak of her coming so close 4 times. And she said many times that had she won that gold medal in Torino, the pressure, having just fulfilled the things she was supposed to do, she would have quit the sport, she would have gone surfing, hung up her snowboard, and that would have been it. And instead, that loss really fueled the greatest career in the history of the sport. She's come back for her 5th Olympics. I don't think anyone saw her staying this long. What she has done for that sport has been remarkable. So to watch her win not 1, but 2 gold medals, because they added a mixed gender event where she raced with Nick Baumgartner, who was his own incredible story at 40 years old. And to see her win 2 gold medals in her 5th Olympics and finally on the world stage prove that she is the greatest of all time and fill in that little missing blank in her resume with the Olympic gold. The only 2-time gold medalist at these games and one of just the brightest spots of the Beijing Olympics for Team USA was so remarkable to see.
It was a real redemption story for sure. I want to ask you, Robert Samuel, speaking of redemption, you raised the question in the piece that you wrote for the Post yesterday. What has become of this sport, speaking of women's figure skating? And we talked about all the drama around it at the top of the show. But what do you see happening from here? What kinds of changes do you think might happen around women's figure skating to try to prevent some of the drama that we've witnessed over the last few days?
Well, what we saw yesterday really unlocked some of the problems that had been stewing up in the sport for a while, right? And I think you know, Anna Shcherbakova, when she ended her performance and won the gold medal, said she needed to sit in a room by herself and ask herself some questions. It seems that people who govern the sport of figure skating need to do the same. The first question, I think, has to do with the age limit. Now, one of the things that facilitated the idea that Valieva compete is that she's only 15 years old. And because of that, she's protected from some of the harsher sanctions that come to athletes who are over 16. So I think there's a real conversation that needs to be happened about what is the appropriate age for a person to compete. Now, the other thing that's important is that we've seen a very intense change in who becomes a champion in figure skating. So over the past 10 years, there's been almost a conveyor belt of ephemeral champions who are coming from Russia, specifically coming from the rink where Kamila Valieva and Alexandra Trusova and Anna Shcherbakova practice, Sambo 17. Now, what's been happening is that there are these skaters who, because they're so young, their bodies aren't fully developed. They can soar high in the air, land jumps that are as difficult, sometimes more difficult than what Nathan Chen, who won the gold medal in the men's event, can do. Then by the time they're 17 or 18, they're broken. Mm. And I mean physically broken. Bad backs, bad knees, bad hips, bad feet. And so there's a question about whether or not what we're seeing, the training mechanisms and being able to launch those jumps at a young age to win, actually fits into what the sport is trying to accomplish and see in a champion, which is a person who skates with maturity and balances some of the more technical acrobatic skills with some of the more basic skills of stroking the ice and shifting from one side of the blade to another. And so I think there'll be a reevaluation of not just who gets to compete, but how this event is scored, and thinking about what the actual future of the sport will look like. Because what we're seeing now, I mean, the fruits of where the sport is headed had come to a really disastrous dark bear, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of looking at the people who won. And because you've seen that, I think it calls into question whether or not the sport's headed in the right direction.
Yeah.
Lots of people, including myself, would say maybe not.
Well, we could do an entire conversation around that alone, but it is time for us to say goodbye. We've got some other things we need to talk about as it relates to China hosting the Olympics, but I want to say thank you to our guests, Alyssa Roenick, who is senior writer for ESPN and has been covering outdoor sports at the Olympics remotely. Alyssa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Robert Samuels is a national political enterprise reporter for The Washington Post, but he has also been covering figure skating for the Post for the Olympics. Robert, thanks so much for making time to be with us on Radio Times.
Anytime, Tracy.
Well, if you are just joining us, you're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. And, of course, we've been talking about the 2022 Winter Olympic Games, which will be over in just a couple of days. But the controversy around China as the host country remains. China has had a notoriously poor record on human rights, cracking down on dissenters and subjecting Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities to mass detentions, forced labor, and other horrors. While American athletes were allowed to compete, the Biden administration chose not to send an official delegation to the Games as a diplomatic boycott to protest China's record on human rights. So joining us with more on the difficult questions around the 2022 Beijing Olympics are Johar Ilham, who is a Uyghur advocate and author. Her father, Ilham Toti, has been sentenced to life in prison in China for his writings. Johar, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
And also joining us is Sophie Richardson, China Director for Human Rights Watch. She has published extensively on human rights and political reform there and across Southeast Asia. Sophie, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Johar, let me begin with you, because you certainly know from deeply personal experience how human rights are being violated in China. You come from a Uyghur family. Let's begin by explaining who the Uyghurs are, and then tell us your father's story.
Sure. Uyghurs are a Turkic ethnic majority peoples, Muslim majority peoples, who are living in a region called, in Chinese, it's called Xinjiang, and I prefer to call it the Uyghur region, and it's located west part of China. And Uyghurs for hundreds of years have been living in this land, and then we practice a different religion from the Han Chinese majorities. We speak a different language, we look different, we have different culture and customs. And but as you may know, that for the past few years, actually starting since decades ago, the Chinese government had been implementing repressive policies in the Uyghur region, especially for the past few years. And hundreds of thousands of family and range of 1 million to 1.8 million people have been persecuted by the Chinese government in different kinds of ways, from, you know, locked up in concentration camps, re-education camps, or locked up in prisons, like my father and my cousin.
Oh. And what happened
and
with
my father, Ilham?
I'm sorry, go ahead. Tell us about your father.
Yes, my father, Ilham Tohti, is a well-known economist since he moved to mainland China from our hometown to Beijing in his when he was about 15 or 16 years old, and he spent decades in Beijing teaching economics related topics on the Uyghur region. And a few years before he was arrested, he was officially arrested, he built a website and called UyghurBiz.com, where he wanted to create a platform for people to exchange ideas. Since many of you are aware, social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, where people can exchange ideas and information, are banned in China. Searching engines like Google is also banned in China. So my father wanted to provide a free platform for people to exchange their ideas, and he often commented on China's policies towards the Uyghur people and on the region. And that's one of the main reasons why he was locked up in prison, and he's actually now serving a life sentence on separatism related charges. Mm-hmm. The Chinese government accused him for being a separatist, someone, an extremist, and someone who advocated for violence, but it's exact opposite of who he is.
And Johar, you might have been locked up with him. The way that events sort of played out, just tell us very briefly what happened when you were with him and you were planning to leave, and one of you left and the other one did not.
Yes. Growing up, we always have policemen coming to visit us, and sometimes it would take our entire family to house arrest. But things got really bad starting from 2013, February 2nd, which was the last time I saw my father. We were separated at the Beijing International Airport. He was arrested at the airport, and because I was a teenager, the Chinese government considered me as no threat, and they allowed me to leave. They gave me the option to stay or leave, and my father, at the airport, he forced me to take the chance and leave the country. And since then, I have never been able to go back because of the risk of my safety. And I know if I go back, just like many other Uyghurs who have traveled back to their homeland, they're locked up. So I'm afraid that will happen to me too. And for the past 8 to 9 years, I've been speaking up on behalf of my father and calling on the release of my father and so many innocent Uyghurs.
And what have you heard of your father's condition since that time?
So the last time I heard anything about my father was actually 2017, about 5 years ago. Since then, no one from my family members were able to visit him. So according to China's own constitutional law, every prisoner has the right to be visited by their families and their lawyers at least every month. But for my family, he wasn't allowed to be visited by families until 6 months after he was sentenced. And after that, he was only allowed to be visited every 3 months. So it's already against China's own law. And even that 3 month visiting rights already been taken away since 2017. We don't know what is really happening to him and if he's even alive. The last time we heard, we knew he was denied food twice, each time for 10 days, and he lost 40 pounds within a few months. He was beaten, shackled, and questioned, interrogated, and he had a small TV put in his small cell room. He's locked up solitary confinement, and in his small room, in that TV, the 24 hours, 7 days, nonstop would be playing loud noises. In a loud noise, they would be playing Chinese propaganda videos. And it's torturing him both physically and mentally.
Sophie Richardson, I want to bring you in. We have just about a minute before I have to take a break. But what Johar is describing sounds not unusual and not unfamiliar as it relates to the treatment of detainees in China.
You are tragically correct. We spend an enormous amount of time detailing not just the mass arbitrary detention, you know, through which we believe that at least a million Uyghurs have been held wholly outside of any discernible law and tortured and effectively tormented into giving up their identities over the last several years. But there is no shortage of high-profile cases in which authorities cook up reasons for prosecuting people and essentially take them off the grid and then provide no information to family members. It happens all the time domestically in cases against human rights lawyers. For example, a well-known lawyer named Ding Jiaxi, there's very little information about what's happened to him. Mm. Or even in the cases of people who have dual citizenship or foreign citizenship, there's a Swedish publisher.
Sophie, I'm going to stop you right there because I do have to take a quick break, but please hold that thought. We're talking about the Olympics and also China's human rights record. More of Radio Times when we come right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the Beijing Olympics, which will close on Sunday, but also about the very uncomfortable questions around having the Olympics in a country that is known for its human rights abuses. We welcome you to add your voice to the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Our guests are Johar Ilham, who is a Uyghur advocate and an author, and she's the daughter of a Uyghur scholar who was sentenced to life in prison in China for his writings. Also with us is Sophie Richardson, who is the China director at Human Rights Watch. And Sophie, I'm sorry, I had to interrupt you. We were talking about how what Johar was describing about the treatment that her father received is not unfamiliar, not uncommon for detainees in China, and how well documented the abuse has been. So I invite you to go ahead and finish your thought.
Sure, thanks. I was just going to reference another well-known case of a publisher who is originally from the mainland but had acquired Swedish citizenship. His name is Gui Minhai, who was actually effectively abducted from his home in Thailand and taken to the mainland where he was prosecuted on trumped-up charges. And his daughter, Angela Gui, has campaigned, much as Johar has so bravely for their fathers, and, you know, been denied even the most basic access and basic information about the whereabouts, the well-being, and the status of their family members. It happens all the time.
And Sophie, it invites the question, why would China be allowed to host not one but two Olympics over the last 14 years, given the human rights abuses that have been, as we said, well documented?
Well, I think at this point we have to conclude it's that the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, simply chooses not to care about these issues. You know, it has now, after it awarded the Chinese government this round of games that's just finishing in 2015, it has now adopted certain human rights requirements for host cities, but it then argued that those wouldn't apply for these particular games. That said, there's no reason that it couldn't have tried much harder. You know, and there are other obligations baked into the Olympic Charter, for example, that the IOC really could have pushed much harder with the Chinese authorities, but it simply chose not to.
Yeah. Johar, the Chinese government made the decision to have a Uyghur athlete light the Olympic torch at the opening ceremonies in Beijing, and that shocked a lot of people. What did you make of that, and what do you think the message behind that was?
When I saw that, first of all, the Uyghur lady that lit up the torch, she actually shares the exact same last name as I did, Ilham Jan. And that really made me feel extra horrible because we're both, we both women and we both have same last name. And we both are under Chinese government's control, even though I am in the U.S., even though she has the honor to light up a torch. We're still in Chinese government's control in all kinds of ways. And having an Uyghur person lighting up the torch exactly reminded me of in 1936 when Nazi government had chosen one Jewish athlete to lighten the torch at that time. Doesn't it sound very familiar? And also, I'm afraid that the Chinese government didn't care what impact this would bring to the world. And basically, the Chinese government wanted to use this as a propaganda tool as well to show that Uyghurs are indeed living happily and there's no human rights abuses happening in the Uyghur region at all.
And Johar, there was a rather testy news conference yesterday involving the head of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, and a Chinese official who was described as sort of going off on reporter questions about forced labor, about mass detentions and torture, and that her answers were very political. She denied and said that it was a bunch of lies and those things are not happening at all. And then apparently there was a sidebar meeting after which everybody came out and said, listen, we reaffirm our stance that politics and sports should remain separate from one another. Can you talk about the way in which the head of the International Olympic Committee address that and sort of how the IOC has addressed all of these issues around China?
The famous artist Ai Weiwei has once said it, just to not be political, it's a political stand. Mm-hmm. And IOC choosing to turn a blind eye and ignoring that there are vast human rights abuses happening in China, it's a political stance, and they choose to stay silent. That's a political stance, and they are politicizing themselves already. And second of all, that I would like to note that recently IOC issued a statement, basically a due diligence statement, saying that there is no forced labor involved in Olympics branded goods at all. And that just it really, as someone who works in the labor rights monitoring field, it just this is such a false statement. First of all, there's no way for anyone to confirm in such confident way saying that there's no forced labor in China. You can't simply say that in any country. That's the first stance I like to make. And second of all, that Olympic, the two examples that the IOC listed in their due diligence statement as an example, which was the HYX and Anta, both companies had publicly stated that they have always been using Xinjiang cotton, which is the cotton grown in Uyghur region, and that they will always support to do so, even though there have been reports had directly reported that the Xinjiang cotton is heavily tainted by Uyghur forced labor in the Uyghur region. And so how can IOC be so confident and so ignorant about this matter and saying that there's no forced labor was involved in the production of of any uniforms for this Olympics.
Yeah. Sophie Richardson, a couple of questions. One, while the United States did declare a diplomatic boycott of the Games and some other countries followed, Johar just mentioned corporate sponsors, many of them American companies, and they did not choose to boycott. What was the calculus that these companies had to make in deciding whether to participate? And it sort of raises the question of complicity for sponsors, for viewers, for everyone.
Well, the obligation, at least from Human Rights Watch's perspective, on the corporate sponsors was to go through an exercise that's generally referred to as human rights due diligence. You know, this expects companies to express an affirmative responsibility to look around and think through their business operations and make sure that those aren't creating or contributing to human rights violations, and if they are, to remedy them, right? And this is, you know, what businesses say ideally that they want. And we wrote to all of the top sponsors in 2021 and got no meaningful replies from any of them about whether they were going to perform this exercise and or use their you know, the power that they have as sponsors of the Games to push for human rights improvements. You know, and the fact that they really ducked the conversation, not just with us, but indeed at a congressional hearing last summer, I think is a pretty powerful statement of how concerned they are about not losing market access inside China. I think it's a conversation that's not over yet, and there's new legislation taking effect in the U.S. in June that's actually going to require companies that are importing products that might have been made with Uyghur forced labor to prove that their supply chains are clean. And I think that's a statement that reflects the frustration of the U.S. government and of people like Johar and myself about, you know, the lack of willingness to really answer tough questions about forced labor inside China.
Yeah. Sophie, what is the UN and the international community at large doing about this?
It's a great question. You know, as the Games wrap up in Beijing, our attention is shifting very much to Geneva, where the next session of the United Nations Human Rights Council opens next week. And we're certainly hoping that the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, finally publishes a long-awaited report looking at human rights violations in the Uyghur region. Let's be clear. You know, when governments are committing crimes against humanity, as the Chinese government currently is, the typical response is a UN-backed investigation with a view towards prosecutions. But because the Chinese government is so powerful, including within the UN system, we're not even close to that process starting yet. We're still really at the very first stage. And this report is critical. It's overdue. And we're certainly hoping to see it before the council goes into session at the end of February, because that can kickstart a process of longer-term investigations and ideally prosecutions for people who are committing atrocity crimes.
Johar, for people who may be listening to this conversation, who have been following the Olympics, who are well aware of the human rights abuses in China and may feel a degree of helplessness along with their frustration, what can people as individuals do in their own way to try to address this?
Oh, I love to share a lot on that. There are many things people can do. And I really want to let people know that please do not underestimate your power. We are each individual of us. We are so strong. Our voices matter. The reason that authoritarian regimes around the world try to shut human rights advocates up, try to shut political dissidents up, because they know how powerful people's voices can be. So please do not underestimate your power, and please practice your fundamental rights, which is your freedom to expression. And so educate yourself on this topic, read a lot, hear from Uyghurs' perspectives, prioritize their voices. And besides, after being educated, spread the word, let other people to know about it. You never know where your words are going to reach and who it's going to reach to. Maybe one day, maybe in one chance, you will trigger a change. You might not see it yourself, but for sure, someone's life is going to be changed by you. And we might not have control over which companies, where are they sourcing from, where are they going to manufacture their clothing. But what we do have control over is our own wallet, we have control over where to spend our money. Do we want to spend money on goods that are for sure tainted by forced labor or at high risk of tainted by forced labor? Or do we want to spend money on those brands who have chosen to do the right thing, have risked their market profit in China just to be on the right side of history? Do we want to reward them by purchasing from them instead of from those brands who have actively ignored or refused to be committed to, you know, stop the Uyghur forced labor practices? So, and there are a lot of brands that are doing the right thing. For instance, I can name a few just for the listeners, like Marks and Spencer, Island Fisher, Reformation, New Look, OVS, We Fashion. All of these brands have been doing extra steps to verify their supply chains to make sure that they're not putting their consumers at risk of purchasing goods from Uyghur forced labor. And that is an act that we should be praising, that we should be rewarding.
And also, Johar, as you know, the athletes in the Olympics were warned by the Chinese government not to stage any sort of protest or risk, as they put it, certain punishment. What is your hope about athletes? That what do you hope that they will do when they leave China and return to their home countries in terms of perhaps speaking out about what's happening there? What are you hoping for?
I really do hope that there will be more athletes. Already previously there were some athletes commenting on this matter, and I hope that after coming back home, after they feel safe, they could also feel, you know, be encouraged and to feel courageous enough to speak up on this issue, because Uyghurs are not the only group that is suffering. There are Hong Kongers, Tibetans, Inner Mongolians, even Chinese Christians, Chinese human rights lawyers, those who share differences, have different ideologies from the Chinese Communist Party. Those people are persecuted, and their stories need to be highlighted. And I really hope those athletes who have, you know, large platform, who have large followers, who can influence people, please speak up on this matter, and please use your power, use your voice.
And Sophie, in our last couple of minutes here, how does China likely emerge from these Olympics in the eyes of the world? There was reporting that, you know, the first time around it was China looking for acceptance. This time around, it's China flexing its domestic muscle. How do they emerge from this?
Well, Xi Jinping and his allies will no doubt present the Games as having been, you know, a triumph and a success, and will spin it as having received global political legitimacy. I think a lot of other governments and different communities see it differently. I mean, even if you're looking at, you know, athletes frustrated with doping scandals, or, you know, journalists who say they've been treated like inmates, or ordinary people across China who maybe wanted to express some criticism even just of hosting the games but weren't allowed to do that. I think a lot of other players come away with a very different and fairly grim assessment.
Yeah. And in our last minute or so here, your thoughts, we talked with Johar about this, but your thoughts about how to kind of keep the spotlight on this issue after the athletes have gone home.
Well, I of course, agree with everything that Johar said. I think, people need to be aware of and mindful, you know, not just of the Chinese government's efforts to silence criticism inside the country, but globally too, and what the consequences for people around the world might be, whether it's the Chinese government's efforts to weaken international human rights institutions or to push forward rights-free development around the world, or even to, you know, threaten academic freedom at universities here in the United States. These are all serious problems that require a lot more attention.
Yeah. You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY, and we have been talking about the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. The closing ceremonies are scheduled to be held this Sunday, but of course, all throughout the Olympics, there has been this question of, you know, the wisdom of holding the Olympics in a country, a host country, that is known for its human rights abuses. Of course, we've also talked about some of the highlights and some of the moments that we all will remember long after these Olympics are over. Let me take a moment to thank our guests. Johar Ilham, thank you so much for making time to be with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Tracy, for having me.
And
it's
Sophie,
an honor to be here.
Well, we are delighted to have you. And Sophie Richardson from Human Rights Watch, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Our producers today are Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. Our engineer has been Al Banks. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.